Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, our friend Jonathan Merritt. How you doing, Jonathan?
Hey, good to be with you.
Jonathan, if you don't know, is the senior columnist for the Religion News Service and the author of the new book, Jesus is Better Than You Imagined. How'd you like that introduction?
That was good. That was nice.
Yeah. You know, I'm really terrible about book titles. I never get them right.
Well, you got mine exactly right.
Well, this is the second podcast that you've been on, so I should get your book right by now.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. So you've gone back down to Georgia from New York, having a good 4th of July?
Yep. I'm just here temporarily. I'm here for a week with the fam. I'm going to be doing a little bit of speaking. I do a lot of consulting with authors and writer coaching. So I'm going to get to meet with an author while I'm here. So I'm trying to make a whole trip of it rather than just sort of sitting around and grilling out with the parents, which we will do. But
yes,
we're going to do some work while I'm here too. So it'll be good.
I kind of imagine this as like the boy who leaves the country and goes off to the big city, and now you're coming back home and you're dealing with a bunch of people like, hey, Jonathan, how come you didn't have socks on that interview with MSNBC? That kind of stuff. Does that happen?
You know, that's so funny you mentioned that. I can't tell you how many people have made comments about the fact that I was wearing sockless tennis shoes on MSNBC. That's so funny that you brought that up. But yeah, some people did mention that.
Well, I figured some people would definitely get a kick out of that, but yeah, nice touch on that, by the way.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of MSNBC, we want to talk to you because this last week there's been quite a kerfuffle with the Hobby Lobby stuff, and you seem to be in not the center of it. You're not obviously testifying to the court or anything like that, but you've been a big voice all over TV. You've been on MSNBC and CNN about this. So I wanted to bring you on the show and maybe give a little update on kind of what's going on. And so how about we start off this way? For those who have their head in the sand, who have no clue what's going on, can you give them like a 40-second recap of what's going on with all the Hobby Lobby stuff?
Yeah, well, basically what happened is the Affordable Care Act, which has been sort of given the colloquial nickname Obamacare, it passed. And as a result of that passage, there were certain things that had to be included in employer healthcare plans. I mean, one of those is preventative care. One is an inability to exclude people for pre-existing conditions. And the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, they mandated the coverage of contraceptives in all employee healthcare plans a couple of years back. Now, this really upset folks, partially because people just don't like Obamacare, conservatives in particular. But it also bothered folks because out of the 20 FDA-approved drugs that are considered contraceptives, four of those drugs, Ella, Plan B, and I think two kinds of IUDs, intrauterine devices, even though there's not any scientific evidence to sort of prove this, there is some suspicion that some of those may prohibit the implantation of a fertilized egg or, in pro-life terms, cause an abortion. And so there were a lot of organizations who were outraged by that. The United Council of Catholic Bishops, they were upset that you would have to provide contraceptives at all. And then evangelicals were upset that you would have to provide just those four abortifacients or abortion-causing drugs that they believe may cause abortions. The Obama administration came out and provided an exemption for houses of worship. Then you had religious nonprofits, Catholic charities, Catholic hospitals and such who said, wait a minute, we should be exempt too. They came out with an accommodation, which some people said was not an accommodation at all, which basically said you don't have to provide the contraceptives, but we will require instead the healthcare insurer to provide those contraceptives through a third party at no cost to you, which the counter-argument was, well, then the price gets passed back on to us anyway, and we do end up providing it. As a result of that, Hobby Lobby, which is run by the Green family, an outspoken group of evangelical Christians out in Oklahoma City, they said, we don't want to cover it. We don't want to cover those four. We've already provided the 16. In fact, they actually provided 17. Plan B was covered in their previous health insurance coverage. They dropped it after, not before, Obamacare was passed. And they said, we don't want to cover it. So they representing, I think, 42 other for-profit businesses said, we're going to sue the federal government. We don't think that we should have to cover this. They worked their way up through the courts, eventually landed on the steps of the Supreme Court. They decided to hear their case. And then this last week, they released on Monday at 10 a.m. a decision saying that, ruling in favor with a 5-4 decision in favor of Hobby Lobby and saying that if you are a private company, if you are what the Supreme Court said, a closely held company, which I believe is like a held by a group of 50 individuals or more, you're not a public company, you're held by a small group of individuals, then you should not be burdened with this if you believe it conflicts with your religious beliefs. And so Hobby Lobby won that decision. And it's really been divisive for a lot of people on the left who believe that, you know, withholding contraceptives from women is a bad thing.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, you said you were clear to say that the Green family, Hobby Lobby, removed Plan B from their health care after, not before, Obamacare. Why were you so emphatic to say that?
Well, because it's been a point of debate, because they say we cannot provide these four kinds of contraceptives, when in fact, prior to the passage of Obamacare, they were already providing it. Another point of contention that has come up, which was in a report that was released by Mother Jones Magazine, which is, I would say, a far left-leaning publication, was that in their 401k plans, in their retirement plans, their mutual funds that they give to their employees, they're investing, I believe the number is $73 million. It's tens of millions of dollars are being invested in companies that actually make IUDs.
Really?
Which are another one of the types of contraceptives that they say they don't want to cover. So these things have been brought up, sort of raise the question as to whether or not this is politically motivated, or whether or not it is truly been motivated out of a religious conviction.
Okay. Now, in hearing everything that you've said and hearing your interviews and what you've written, it sounds like you might not be for this ruling. But in one of your interviews, I think it was the CNN one, you come out and say that you are pro-life. And so it seems weird that a person who is pro-life wouldn't be as emphatically supportive of this ruling.
I'm actually not opposed to the ruling, believe it or not. People are sort of shocked when they hear me say that. No. I am pro-life. I think that people, and as is often the case when you deal with partisan issues, people don't have all the facts, and they're not judging all the facts. You know, they're sort of listening to Fox News 24/7 or MSNBC 24/7, and so they run on a partial set of facts. And so what I've been trying to do is to tell people this is not as simple as you think it is. It's actually more complicated, and trying to explain to people that these issues are not as cut and dry as some people think. That's one of the reasons why I wrote a column in The Week about Hobby Lobby's dealings with China, that if we're going to have this conversation, I think we should have it completely, and to deal with sort of the murkiness and muddiness and complexities of issues like these.
Mm-hmm. When you brought up China, it sounded like your argument for including that was, if they're going to be considered a Christian company, then they have to be completely consistent with their ethic across the board. And if I understand you correctly, you're pointing to that saying, if you are a Christian company, then you can't be supportive of an environment, a country that has such harsh situations and stipulations that are very detrimental to so many people. Is that right?
Well, yeah, basically what the article did was there were actually two arguments that I was making sort of side by side. And I think a lot of conservatives were tone deaf to either or both of those. The first is that there's this idea going on right now, and this ruling actually solidified it, this idea of corporate personhood, okay, which means corporations are people. Mm-hmm. There was a case that was put forward in the Supreme Court that involved Citizens United, where they said that corporations have political positions and should be treated like individuals, that they should be allowed to sort of express their political views and their right to express those in terms of free speech. This really extended, at least to closely held companies, the idea that individual liberties are extended to corporations, that corporations are in some sense just like people, and because they're people, they have rights. Well, an extension of that is that people are calling corporations Christian. Not that they're just businesses owned by Christians, but they are ontologically different. That the corporation itself is different because it's owned by Christians and it should be treated different. That not only the Christians' beliefs who own that company should be protected, but that the corporation's actions or behaviors should also be protected. And so I actually raise the question whether or not, particularly for evangelicals, that term Christian business even makes sense. And I argue that for conservative Christians, it doesn't actually make sense. It doesn't. And it doesn't for a number of reasons, one of which being that the Bible never, not one time, ever, does it apply that term to corporations, to organizations, to businesses, or even to governments. It only applies it to individuals. And so you can talk about businesses that are owned and operated by Christians. I think that's a fair way to describe it. But you can't say, well, but Hobby Lobby is Christian. Because an organization, if you're a conservative evangelical in particular, can never be Christian. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I brought up there was, here you have an organization that's making the argument, we cannot be forced to spend our money in a way that conflicts with Christian values. And yet, if you notice that they're buying cheap goods, they're stocking their stores with cheap goods purchased from China. You go into any Hobby Lobby, you flip over an item, you're going to find a little oval sticker that says made in China. And yet, China is the 20th worst country in the United around the globe for child labor. They have nightmarish workplace conditions. 70,000 people a year die from unsafe work environments. They are a country that pays people insanely low wages, not as low as some, but still very, very low, even though they've raised their minimum wage even this year. The best case scenario would be having your goods made in Shanghai, and Shanghai, which is the province that has the highest minimum wage of all of mainland China, only pays workers $9.77 US per day. So the fact that they're making goods over there, I think, implicates them in a lot of things that conflict with Christian values. So here you have a company saying, well, we can't be forced to spend our money in a way that conflicts with Christian values, and yet they're doing it willingly already.
Okay, so let's talk about the China issue. You actually quoted a guy named Dr. Russell Moore, and his response to this was something about, it's obviously a very different question from whether the government ought to force employees to pay for their drugs that cause abortions compared to using China. What is your response to that? If his argument is you're comparing apples to oranges, it's not the same thing. What is your response?
Yeah, my response is, first of all, I wasn't talking about the apple. So it's sort of a sleight of hand. I mean, if you go back and you read that article about China, the question in there had nothing to do with the Supreme Court. I wasn't saying, well, just because you buy goods from China, you should lose your case before the Supreme Court. I do think those issues are different. But just because they're different doesn't mean they're unrelated. Mm-hmm. So what I was saying is, here you have an organization who says they can't, well, take China's one-child policy, for example. By importing tens of millions of goods from China every year, they are putting millions of dollars into a government that is using that money to execute a one-child policy. Well, you say, what's a one-child policy? They limit families to having one child in China. Well, as a result of that, you have a history there of forced sterilizations, of forced abortions. 35,000 abortions are performed in China every single year or every single day. You have 330 plus million abortions that have been performed in China. The majority of abortions, and this is not me, this is according to third parties who have reported on this, the majority of abortions there show the characteristics of rape, which means they were performed against the woman's will. You have 19% of the global population of women who reside in China, and over 50% of female suicides take place in China. So here you have people saying, people making the case, we cannot as a matter of conscience, be paying for things that may or may not cause abortions, and yet we're spending tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, to force abortions in China through the amounts of money that we're pouring into their economy. And so I don't think that they are the same issue. Nobody's making that argument. It's a straw man. But I do think that they are linked. I do think they are related, and I think it's a fair question.
But the person who says just because they're inconsistent about one area of practice doesn't mean they have to be inconsistent in all areas of practice. Wouldn't they be saying, hey, okay, so the China thing, it's not a good thing. It's not a good situation. It's terrible that they're supporting that. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to hold their beliefs about abortion and these IUDs and these other Plan B type things.
Well, this is the problem. And I agree. I see what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of people came back and said, oh, yeah, well, aren't you writing this article on a Mac? Well, sure I am. But I'm not making the argument that Hobby Lobby is making. So what's your point? I'm not the one out here saying I have to be completely consistent in the way I spend my money. I accept the fact that to participate in the modern marketplace, I will oftentimes be forced to or have no other choice but to spend my money on things that are ethically compromised. Now, on the other hand, you have Hobby Lobby saying, absolutely not. No, we cannot make compromises. We cannot make compromises when it comes to funding things that compromise the sanctity of human and infant and unborn life. We cannot be forced to compromise in any way when it comes to spending money in a way that's inconsistent with Christian values. And so what I'm saying is, here you have a company saying we cannot be inconsistent. And they're being inconsistent. Mm-hmm. And so I think that has to be a part of the conversation. So it doesn't make any sense to point it back at me. Here I am saying, of course, I'm inconsistent on everything, but I'm not the one marching all the way to the Supreme Court saying I can't be inconsistent.
Now, earlier you said that people might be more influenced by politics than by religion or theology. What did you mean by that statement?
Well, I think if you look at conservative evangelicals, you'll find this a lot of times, you look at the way that they discuss issues. They almost always lead with the political, and then they footnote the theological. So, you know, you've got people with China. They'll, and Dr. Moore is one of these people. Even though I have a lot of respect for him, his argument, and a lot of people who side with Dr. Moore on this issue, their argument is essentially, it's essentially twofold. I mean, on the one hand, they go, well, what else are we going to do? Sort of a shoulder shrug. Everybody else does it, right? It's sort of everybody else is doing it argument. The interesting thing is that those same people don't apply those arguments to things like contraceptive coverage. They don't say, well, everybody else is doing it. The government has mandated, so what else are we supposed to do? In fact, they're saying, if you're asked to do this, you should go out of business before you would do something that compromises this. Rather than saying, well, maybe you shouldn't deal in China because it would cut into your profits. No, they're saying, well, this is just the reality of the marketplace and everybody else does it. And so we should do it to stay competitive. That's leading with your politics. That's leading with capitalism. I think additionally, you're hearing people make the argument, which basically, if you distill it down, is, well, the ends justify the means. They say, well, what do you want us to do? By investing all of this money in China, we are giving people jobs, even though we're paying them obscenely low wages so that we can make higher profits. We are, there probably is some child labor that goes on in the manufacturing of our clothing or our coffee mugs, but what the heck? You know, we're still improving the lives of some people. And the idea there is that if you have ethical ends, that it's okay if you have ethically compromised means. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's a good argument. I think we should oppose the ethically compromised means, even if sometimes we can't avoid those means. Yep. That we should always say that those things are unacceptable. And we should, I think, reason with the Apostle James that him who knows the good to do and doesn't do it, to him it is sin.
Yeah. Well, it seems like one of the big issues you've got to wrestle with is how does the individual and the group interact with each other? And you've got this great line that the tide of religious liberty stops at the shore of the common good. Now, on MSNBC, you referred to it as the ocean of religious liberty. So first of all, is it a tide of religious liberty or an ocean?
Well, regardless of how you say it, I don't think the analogy fails. The point is,
no, I think it's a great analogy. Come on, man, you got to pick which one's better. Which word's better?
I like tide. It's shorter.
Okay, okay. That's a great line. I mean, but it's a really, it's a great line. I wasn't making fun of you. I thought it was a really good one. You always have great lines. And so that's the big issue is like, how do you interact with a group of people where your religious liberties and their freedom don't interact well together? And so there are a ton of issues that are going to be dealt in that very same subject matter. So give us some ways that we can think about how that interacts, how we can do that.
Well, I mean, I think you have to think about it, first of all, in terms of the way that it's been defined in this case. I mean, one of the things that they've said is that you cannot substantially burden somebody's religious liberty. In other words, if somebody if they feel like they have a particular conviction, the law cannot burden them to violate that conviction unnecessarily. And you say, well, what does that mean? Because it's not a math equation. How do you know if it's substantial enough to sort of violate that? And I think one of the things that they've said is that there has to be a considerable interest in terms of the government and the common good of the people in order to override that. And they said in this case, there was not the common good, the interest of the people, the public interest, did not outweigh religious liberties. And so what you see here is that you're constantly negotiating these things. And in this case, I think it was probably negotiated acceptably. I think the government should have provided contraceptives themselves if they were interested in providing those things to begin with. These things are not exceptionally expensive. They should have done what they're already doing and said, you know what, you come to the health department and we'll cover those things. But we're constantly negotiating those things. A great example would be to look at the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the civil rights movement and the 1950s, you had people saying, I cannot have the mixing of races in my restaurant, in my shop, in my hair salon. And they were making these things, particularly in the southeastern United States, not just on like arbitrary bigoted grounds, but on theological grounds. Yep. And people were saying that we believe that the races are separate. You look at particularly Southern Baptists at that time, they were making these arguments that we should keep the races pure, we should keep them separate, that the Bible actually prescribes this. And the government said, we know that you have that conviction, but the economy, the common good, the public interest outweighs that. And so we believe that we can place that burden on your conscience, your religious conviction, and override that because it is in the public interest. And so there are times that the government says this is in the public interest and times that it isn't. And I think in this case, they ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby, saying there was not a substantial enough interest that the government had in the matter that they could override their religious convictions.
Yeah. How do you see this playing out in the future? What other issues do you think this is going to touch on?
Well, I think it's going to touch on a lot of things. People are raising the question whether or not it will touch on Jehovah's Witnesses coming forward and saying, we shouldn't be forced to provide healthcare that provides blood transfusions. People have brought up the Christian Scientist angle and said, well, you know, we shouldn't have to provide healthcare at all. Or what about a Muslim or a Jewish person who says we shouldn't have to provide pork-based vaccines? Or an evangelical who says, in California, who says, I think that medical marijuana is immoral and I shouldn't have to provide that in my health coverage. I think it's possible that these things will come forward. I think there was a great article in the week this past week that said essentially you don't have to worry about those things because the court generally only rules in favor of conservative Christians on culture war issues in these matters. So if it comes to an American Indian who wants to smoke peyote, you know, they rule against them. So, you know, we'll just have to see how those things come down. But here's the deal. Anytime the Supreme Court rules on a matter like this, pro or con, you end up with a big mess that you have to unravel. It's the old rock in a pond analogy. There are always going to be ripples. So we've got a lot of implications from this case because they ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby. There would have been a lot of implications if they had ruled against Hobby Lobby. And now we'll just have to see exactly how those things play out as different cases come forward and the court navigates those.
Now, what is your suggestion for how Christians individually should navigate these type of situations?
Well, you know, I don't attempt to be the Holy Spirit in people's lives. So if you have a closely held company, if you've got a small business and you now have under the law protection on contraceptives, I think you should operate according to your own convictions. I think in the case of contraceptives personally, I think it's problematic for Christians. I think it's problematic, particular for pro-life Christians, to say no contraceptives at all. We're not going to provide any of them, even if you don't want to provide the four. The reason for that is when contraceptive access to contraceptives go down, then contraceptive use goes down. When contraceptive use goes down, unintended pregnancies go up. When unintended pregnancies go up, abortions go up. So if you say that you are pro-life, I think you have to be, in some sense, even if it's limited, you have to be pro-contraception, unless, of course, you're Roman Catholic and you accept that sort of type of theology. But if you're evangelical, if you're a Protestant Christian and you claim to be pro-life, I think you should be, in some sense, pro-contraception. And I do think that it's fair to say it does unnecessarily burden one of the sexes, one of the genders, when you say we're not going to provide contraception, because it allows men to engage in sexual actions with women and then basically say, hey, it's on you. You have to deal with it. If you get pregnant because we have been irresponsible, then you're the one that's going to shoulder the burden of the pregnancy, of raising the child. You're the one that's going to have to spend the money to alleviate this problem, to take care of this problem. And not that we refer to children as problems, but I think it's fair to say there are hurdles that are created in a woman's life as a result of a pregnancy. There are difficulties. We all admit that children can be difficult. They're serious responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so in order to deal with these responsibilities that have now been placed on you, that you've got to invest some personal capital there, and I don't. And I think that we should, in some ways, just from that perspective, level the playing field, at least with some basic contraceptives, that that men and women should be on a level playing field there in terms of responsibility when it comes to sexual behaviors.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, I want to kind of change gears here for a second. I wanted to bring something else up about your book. Now, as an interviewer, I'm sure you have this happen to you all the time, where you interview someone and then you know there's a question you wanted to ask and you just forget to ask it. You ever have that happen?
Yeah, that's happened quite a few times, sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so I want to talk about your book, and there's a question that I wanted to ask, and as soon as we got done with our interview a couple months ago, I thought, I missed it. But you're back on the show now, and so I get to have a second shot at it.
It's great.
Miracles happen every day. Okay, so in your book, one of the things you talked about was the skill that you developed of wearing the mask. Remember that section?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, and so as a pastor's kid, obviously there's a lot of expectations placed on you. As pastors, there's a lot of expectations placed on people. As religious leaders, there's expectations. And so all of us have this tendency to do that. But yours is especially as the son of a very prominent Southern Baptist pastor. Your dad was the president of Southern Baptist for how many years? A couple years? Right?
A couple years, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Now, my question was, how did your dad respond to you talking about putting on a mask because of his occupation? Have you guys talked about it?
Yeah, we have. And you know, here's the thing. I think most people, they come to a particular stage in their adult life where the defense mechanisms that allowed them not to cope with childhood issues, which we all have, the defense mechanisms wear out. And at that point, you have a choice. You can either shelve it all and deny it and pretend that you don't have any of these childhood issues. And then you become kind of one of those bitter people where all your friends know you have issues, but you're the only one that apparently is sort of like not clued into it. Or you can actually begin to try to work those things out either in a healthy or an unhealthy way with your parents. I decided to try to work those things out, to confront those things, to pursue emotional and mental health in those ways by really working those things through with my parents. And so if you were to ask my dad or my mom either, you know, if there were some significant failures growing up that were probably a result of growing up in a home like that, where you sort of lived in a fishbowl and under the spotlight, they would say, absolutely there were. And in fact, we've been honest about those things together. We've been able to confess with each other, those things. We've been really, I would say in the last couple of years, in somewhat of a grieving process where you have to grieve those failures and you have to say, I failed you in this way and I'm going to grieve it. And you failed me in that way. And we're going to grieve those things together. The interesting thing is when you begin to grieve the failures that you have with parents and with kids, just like if you were to grieve a death with a friend, that the commonality of that grieving experience actually draws you closer together. And so it's strengthened our relationship. Do I think that it stung a little bit to read some of those things? I think probably it did. I think my dad, my mom would tell you that it did. You know, when my parents got done reading it, I said, "What did you think?" And they looked at me and said, "Well, we'll say it was worse than we thought, but it was also better than we thought."
What do they mean, worse than they thought?
I think it hurt a little more to read some of the things and the exact wording, to see me work it out publicly. But I think also they knew that there was that this was a process of sort of coping and yeah. figuring things out for me to work things out as a writer this way. Yeah. And you know, nothing was so. It wasn't like there were failings on some cataclysmic level. But they were, you know, there were some failings that I think were substantial where I had to get, I came home from counseling, spending a couple of weeks actually out, away in counseling. And I came home and was able to say to my parents, you know, here was an area where you did your best and your best wasn't good enough. And I think that that happens a lot with parents. And if you cannot be honest to say you did your best, you did all you could do, but your best wasn't good enough at this time, in this moment, in this way. If you can't do that, you're not going to get past a lot of those failings because you're not going to recognize they did their best and they'll never recognize that their best wasn't good enough.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm hearing this as a pastor who has three kids, and that would be awful if one of my daughters said that to me. But I get what you're saying. I get that that's part of the healing process that you have to be really honest about some of the wounds everyone has. I get that. But so that's got to be really painful for your parents.
Well, I think it's you're not just speaking as a pastor, but a pastor who's how old are you?
32.
Okay, a 32-year-old.
Remember last time we talked, you tried to tell someone that I was like 23 or something.
Okay, well you still look like you're about 23. Have you had to shave yet?
I'm older than you, man. I'm sure. Older than you. Seriously.
I think as a 32-year-old pastor, you know, I don't know how much time you spend with older people in general, but they all sort of tell me this. You begin to move into that phase where you begin, instead of looking forward on life, you start looking back. You're looking more in your rear view. You're going to more funerals than you're going to weddings. And I think in that case, what happens is the idealism that most 20-something and 30-something parents have falls away. Yeah. You become painfully aware of all of those mistakes. I can tell you, if you rewound the tape at 30-something years old, you know, I think my parents would say, like most parents, well, I'm not really failing in any substantial ways. I mean, that's sort of the nature of failures, right? It's not nefarious.
We're not aware of them. Yeah.
You don't know of them until you get past them. And so there are all kinds of failings right now. You're doing damage to your three daughters and you don't even realize it. There are unintended consequences, things that you think aren't that bad that are that bad. Traumas that they're undergoing that you'll have to repent of later in life. And that's just a function of being a human being. Mm-hmm. And so you have to work those things out, I think, later in life. But the question is can we ever get honest with those things? I mean, I'm sure you would be able to say if you were honest and you look back on your parents' life and the way that they would probably say about the way that they raised you as well. Hey, here's an area where you failed me and you didn't even know it. And I think we have to get to the point where we are willing to get honest about those things, just like we are able to say, my 12-year-old self, here's where I screwed up. My 14-year-old self, here's where I screwed up. I'm going to confess that and move on with it. And what happens, I've found, when we're willing to get honest about those failures with each other, both of us, and we're willing to begin to heal together, all of those things, because as one counselor told me, you really spend the majority of your life working out what happened between 5 and 15. When you're willing to start dealing with those things in your life, I think what happens is those, it feels almost like an emotional muscle that's been tense inside of you, that's been in a knot, gets to relax. And there are muscles, I think, inside a lot of us. We don't even know what those strains are. We don't know why we're short-tempered over certain things. We don't know why we're quirky about certain things. We don't know why we're destructive in relationships in certain ways. But when we begin to deal with those things, we uncover those areas where there was an emotional muscle that tensed up mm-hmm. and hasn't been able to relax for many years. And when we invite Christ and other people into those situations, I think we begin to massage those muscles out. We allow those muscles to relax, and we can live a better second half, third of life when we do those things, I think.
Okay, so your book's been out for 3 months. I'm assuming your parents probably read it. 6 months ago, 9 months ago. Is that about right?
Probably 9 months ago.
Okay. Yeah. So when they, 12, a year ago, do you think your relationship is a better relationship with your parents now than it was before they read the book?
Yeah. It's not only is it better, it's realer. You see, because when we can't talk about our mask, we don't take our masks off. No. You know, sometimes just naming something robs it of its power.
Mm-hmm.
There's something really powerful about confession, because now it's out there.
Yeah.
And we've had to do that with each other on both sides. You know, anytime you have relationships are all two-way streets. And so we both had to do that. And that has drawn us closer together. We speak more honestly and more openly about all kinds of things than we ever have before. And it has allowed us to begin a journey that I think will continue the rest of our lives. Additionally, you know, when you have these conversations with a father who's 55, 58 years old, it's a lot better than waiting until your father's 78 or 88 years old, because it allows the person a little more runway to make peace with those things, to make up for those things that they failed at, that they didn't even know that they failed at. Yeah. And so I'm not angry. And it's so funny, because there are times where dad or mom will say to me, hey, you know, I thought about this the other day, and I think I should apologize for that. And it's something that was 15, 20 years ago that happened in my life. And I'm able to honestly say, I'm not mad about that. I get it. We're all messed up people. Mm-hmm. And we all make mistakes. And I hope that you know, one day if I ever have kids, you know, that they would forgive me in the same way, or maybe my brothers, as we have worked through things, when they say, hey, this is an area where you failed me as an older brother, a younger brother, as the middle child, that they would give me the same grace and wouldn't be bitter and wouldn't hold it against me, and that we could then all live together in our mutual messiness. And I think that's a learned trait. I think it's a lot easier to attempt to live in shared perfection, which is a myth and a facade, than to live together in our mutual messiness. But I think it's something that's necessary for most of us if we want to live emotionally healthy lives.
Yeah, that's good. The 12-step programs have the great line that you are only as sick as your secrets. And yep. So as you deal with those, that's where you find healing. So I think it's a money-back guarantee. If people read Jesus Better Than You Imagined, the relationships with their parents will be improved.
That's true. And
100% true.
100% money-back guarantee. You send all of your requests to Luke Norsworthy. What's the mailing address?
At jonathan@jonathanmerritt.org or something like that.
.com, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Send it all to those. Okay, so what's next for Jonathan Merritt? What's the next... article that's going to come out that's going to cause a hornet's nest to be unfurled on the internet.
Well, your
4th of July one's already out, so you can't talk about that one.
Out? No. You know, I'm constantly working on articles. I'm working on a couple right now for various publications that I think will be interesting. And then, you know, working on another book idea that's taking shape, that hopefully I'll sign a contract for that by the end of the summer or so. And then that'll be another 18 months after that it'll come out. So
you want to tease? Give people a 15-second tease on subject matter?
You know, one of the ideas that I'm thinking through is a book that is sort of tentatively titled in my mind, Learning to Speak God from Scratch. And it's a book that essentially is the rediscovery of religious language. I think that words are the containers in which our theology, in which our faith lives. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of words in the Christian faith that that, you know, we have a hard time even getting them off our tongue. I think there are other words that have become fossils, that have fallen away, that are extinct, that are actually really helpful. And I think there are some words that we've spoken so often, we don't even know what they mean anymore.
Yeah.
And so what would it look like to go back and to rediscover religious language, to spend time thinking about what does grace really mean when I live that out, when I embody it, when I not only study what the word meant, but also what the word has morphed into and what it means today, what it means for Christians who want to follow Jesus in our day, in our way, but then also what would it mean to embody it? And when I live those things out, when I learn to speak God from scratch, how might those words be re-enlivened or reimagined, or how might meaning come to those words in new ways or in old ways rediscovered?
Yeah.
And so I think that's probably the next book project for me, something in that. Maybe I'll call it You're Talking About God Wrong. I don't know.
That's we'll good. See. Well, that sounds good. Now, are you going to get the interview for the Moses movie with Christian Bale? Now, if you had a choice, would you go with Christian Bale or Aaron Paul, who's playing Joshua in the Moses movie?
I would definitely go with Christian Bale. He's going to have a higher search engine optimization clickability.
Okay, here's the deal.
I'll take the clicks.
I'll take Aaron Paul because I'll just talk to him about Breaking Bad the whole time, and you can have Christian Bale. Deal?
Hey, that sounds good. That sounds good.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.